or afternoon, everybody. If you could take your seats. Okay, we've got, as many of you know, we've got a 3.5-day meeting. Today's agenda, I have one addition to the agenda. At the end of the written agenda, there will be a brief presentation description of a recent Catch Shares task force that was announced by Dr. Jane Lubchenco. I believe Pat Kirkle is going to provide that presentation. There's also a letter from Monica Medina, tab 1, number 5, which lays out the announcement and some of the steps that have been taken by NOAA concerning CatchShare. So if you haven't read it, please do. It's number 5, tab 1. So that'll take place after the 5:15 agenda item. Does anyone else have any other items that they'd like to add to the agenda for today? Okay, seeing none. Just remind you to please silence your cell phones, and also that as a matter of procedure, I like to take a break about every 90 minutes or so to give you an opportunity to stretch your legs, clear your head, have sidebars. So I'll be looking to do that probably before Habitat at this point. With that, I'll get right into reports and activities. I will give the Executive Committee report. Executive Committee met last week on June 16th. A draft summary of that meeting is behind tab 1, number 7. I'll bring up a couple of highlights. The Executive Committee reviewed the background paper on ACLs and AMs, which is our 5:15 agenda item. You remember that staff was directed at the April Council meeting to prepare the paper because the Council had questions about whether there should be a consistent policy for ACLs and AMs. So we'll get into that at our second to last agenda item. We also discussed Groundfish Amendment 16, how to handle public comment, and still get through all of the decisions we have to make. We discussed that, and I have made a decision that I'd like to handle the decision document, take the decisions in the order the document lays out. You may have seen that. It's been in your binder. You got it last week. My plan is to go to the public before we make the decisions and ask them what their feelings are on the particular topic, which options they favor or do not favor, and then to bring it to the council, get a motion up on the board, and keep the discussion at the council level. If there are amendments to those motions or things veer off of what the public had an opportunity to comment on, I will go back to the public. If it's a straight-up vote on a motion, on an option that has been in the document, I do not plan on going back to the public. I do not plan on having a back and forth. The options are what they are. If they do change, then we'll go back to the public. There was a discussion and a report on the Council Coordinating Committee meeting, the CCC meeting, the annual meeting that we had in Boston. There were three letters that were written as a result of that. There was a letter concerning an initiative to revise NEPA compliance procedures. There's a letter to that effect. There was a request for an extension of the comment period for National Standard 2 guidelines. There was also, I believe, a letter concerning the newly announced task force. There is correspondence in here on that. And then there's a summary of the meeting as well. We reviewed some timeline issues for the EFH Omnibus Amendment and Scallop Amendment 15. It appears now that Scallop Amendment 15 will handle closed Area 1 overlap or access issues. You remember there was a discrepancy, and it appears that Amendment 15 will take the lead there. We discussed funding of SSC members assigned to the SAW-SARC process and agreed that if one of our SSC members is to chair the SAW-SARC process, they should be compensated at the rate that an outside reviewer would be compensated. The next item was a travel authorization and reimbursement section of our council handbook. And there's some clarifying language in there that lays out that the provision for compensation for travel costs for a council member will be based upon either the council member's home address or residence or their place of work. That was I guess you'd call it a loophole. That wasn't clearly identified in the SOPs or the handbook. We discussed the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission request for emergency action to monitor river herring catches in the midwater trawl fisheries. And the executive committee agreed that the request should be discussed and possibly endorsed at this meeting. So under herring, I imagine we'll have a discussion about that letter. We discussed impacts of management actions on other fisheries. The debate or the discussion that we commonly have, if you're going to do this in this fishery, then it may have an impact in some other fishery. So the executive committee asked that the executive director draft a policy for the full council to consider on how we should address this issue. Imagine we'll see that in the fall. We also discussed an ecosystem-based fishery management workshop that the SSC is putting on. That's in August in Newport. Paul will touch on that in his remarks. The Whiting Amendment 19 issue of what we can and can't do in that amendment. If you remember, we're scheduled to take that one up soon. It was felt or presented to the executive committee that ACLs and AMs would pretty much take up all the time that we have in that amendment once we get going, and that discussions about limited access and catch shares in that amendment would probably mean that we wouldn't be able to get the amendment out within a year. And then we discussed the concept of catch shares, and Paul Howard presented to the executive committee the strain of attempting to try to do a catch share amendment or decisions plan by plan at the same time as we're trying to refresh our plans, incorporate new science, put in ACLs and AMs. So it was felt that if we're going to undertake a comprehensive catch share transition plan by plan or across all plans, that the council needs more resources to accomplish that. Any questions? Okay. Paul Howard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of things. The SSC workshop is August 26th and 27th in Newport, Rhode Island, and council members will be invited to attend that. And we're hoping that in 2010 sometime, once we're done with Habitat, we'll start on our ecosystem fishery management plan. Most of the other councils have a plan already, and it has been a priority for some time, and our SSC is going to help us give us some guiding principles for our ecosystem plan. So council members will be invited August 26th and 27th to attend that two-day meeting. Also, we've notified the council members and will soon notify the public that the council will hold a catch shares workshop October 20th and 21st. Right now, Karen's looking for some type of a conference venue where we could spend the night and have breakouts and talk about catch shares from a, looking at it from maybe a holistic standpoint, our specific fisheries, how we want to deal with trade-offs in our different fisheries, and have some experts there to help us through some issues and brainstorming that the council and staff would deal with. So it's a two-day workshop on catch shares. It's totally outside of the NIMS workshop business. And lastly, John mentioned a change in the travel policy. It appears a potential council member had said, geez, I spend the whole summer down in the Caribbean. If I was elected to the council, would you pay for my travel for different meetings from the Caribbean because I always summer there? And I said, ooh, I better put something as a travel policy. So if the council would take a look at this highlight, the executive committee looked at it and thought it was pretty reasonable that we just add this to our travel policy that, you know, normally reimbursement will be based on your residence or primary place of employment. But there may be other instances where that wouldn't stand and be handled on a case-by-case basis. But for the most part, if you were going to vacation in Alaska or something and then expect to make two meetings or something, that we wouldn't reimburse you from there normally. So if you want to take a look at that, if someone wants to make a motion to approve that as a new change to our travel policy, that would be appreciated.
Anyone wants to make that motion? Dave Preble, seconded by Dave Gaethel. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please raise your hand. Fourteen in favor. It's unanimous at this point. 14 seated voting members.
That's Paul. All I have, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions for Paul? Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, Paul, regarding number 11, the Whiting Amendment 19 issues, John has already commented on the executive committee discussion about this particular issue, and I'm still not clear as to what exactly you recommended and what came out of the executive committee. Is the executive committee acting on your recommendation to advise the Whiting committee that it should set aside any further discussion on limited access to that fishery and focus solely on ACLs and AMs?
We're still the staff person that will be working on Whiting is still working on skates, getting that finally approved, and then we're going to scope on our Whiting amendment. So in September, we'll have an agenda item for what does the council want to do with Whiting. My advice was we're finishing up on skates. We're going to start Whiting. And to me, to get three-year specs, to get the ACLs and AMs and run everything through the SSC, it's going to take the full year, all of 2010. But it's going to be a full council debate on what's going to be in the scoping and in the amendment to start Whiting at the September council meeting.
Okay, thank you. I only raised the issue because I was the former chair of the Whiting Committee a few years ago, and of course we had to put Whiting on hold for a number of very good reasons, that is limited access. So it's been, I don't know how many years now since we've initiated discussion on limited access to that fishery, and it looks as if there potentially will be further delay. So I would assume then that in preparation for that meeting there'll be some gathering of all of the background information regarding where we've been and why indeed did we decide to hold off on moving forward with limited access, just to bring the new council members and old council members, for that matter, up to speed on this important issue. Thanks.
Just as a follow-on to that, David, there was some feeling, or my feeling was, that the executive committee listened to but had no input was, if we are going to go to catch shares, that may be an unnecessary step to spend all the time on limited entry and then spend a great deal of time on catch shares. It might be something you can go right through a catch share program without having limited entry. But that'll be totally up to the council.
Any other questions for Paul? Okay, Pat Kirkle.
Thank you. Starting with groundfish, as you know, on May 1st, the interim final rule for groundfish, the measures for the 2009 fishing year became effective. As part of that final rule, we did request comments on the rule. The comment period on that closed on June 12th. We received five comments on the final rule, And as requested by the council and other commenters, we are considering the proposed modifications of the trip limits for Georges Bank Winter Flounder and White Hake. On April 8th, the council requested that we modify the letter of authorization, the LOA, for all midwater trawl vessels fishing in closed area 1 to require 100% observer coverage, prohibit slip caught ends, and require all fish be pumped aboard the vessels so they can be sampled by the observer. We've determined that that's not a simple change to the LOA, and we're considering initiating rulemaking to implement these changes. Effective June 5th, the landing limit of Georges Bank Yellowtail Flounder was reduced to 2,500 pounds per trip for vessels fishing exclusively in the U.S.-Canada management area. Let's see. In May, we sent two letters to each limited access Northeast multi-species permit holder. The first contained the vessel's aggregate landings of groundfish species being considered for allocation in Amendment 16 and specified a process for requesting corrections to landings data in the NIMS database. The second containing the vessel's baseline capacity data and the vessel's potential sector contribution, or PSC, for each stock under four allocation options be considered in Amendment 16. As a result of sending out those letters, the industry has identified some errors in the baseline capacity data that we've provided. We're currently correcting what so far anyway seems to be a very small number of errors, but that will require a recalculation of the PSC for all vessels. With the exception of a very few vessels where the error was specific to that vessel, the changes to an individual's PSC will be nearly imperceptible. The errors being corrected for the aggregate landings data, baseline capacity data, and calculated PSCs are exclusively procedural errors made by NIMS in these releases. Corrected baseline capacity data and PSCs will be released to permit holders in the near future. A summary of the leasing program from May 1st through June 19th. There were 115 leases processed. Of those, 105 were approved, involving 117 distinct permits for a total number of days at sea leased of 2,964.15. The average cost per day at sea leased was $863.57. An update on the limited access general category ITQ implementation. We received 1,200 applications for all categories of LAGC scallop permits, with the majority of the applications being for IFQ scallop permits. The deadline to apply was August 30th. Currently, there have been 288 IFQ, 120 Northern Gulf of Maine, and 304 incidental permits issued. There are also 53 IFQ, 2 Northern Gulf of Maine, and 2 incidental confirmation of permit histories that have been issued. There are still 80 appeals that remain pending final decision, and there are 39 vessels fishing under authorizations, temporary letters of authorization, while their appeal is pending. The final rule for the 2009 spiny dogfish specifications published on May 1st and was effective upon publication. That implements a 12 million pound commercial quota for the 2009 fishing year and a possession limit of 3,000 pounds. On monkfish, we published a notice in the Federal Register June 17th that notifies the public of the reallocation of monkfish research days at sea as exempted days at sea. The monkfish FMP allows for 500 RSA days at sea for each fishing year, and 3 RSA monkfish proposals have been awarded for a total of 449 days at sea for the 2009 fishing year. Therefore, the 51 extra days at sea are available for reallocation to conduct monkfish research specifically. And finally, on the protected resource side, the final rule listing the Gulf of Maine distinct population segments of Atlantic salmon as endangered in an expanded range, now including the larger rivers in Maine, the Androscoggin, thank you, Kennebec, and Penobscot rivers, and the final rule for critical habitat designation for those and the previously listed rivers were published in the Federal Register on June 19th, and both become effective on July 20th. And that's it, Mr. Chairman.
Questions for Pat? Sally?
Thank you. Can you tell us how long you think a ballpark for a rulemaking would take on the herring midwater trawl LOA?
I can't really. I mean, it would be a complete guess on my part. We would go through proposed and final rulemaking, and it would just depend on how complicated the rule was, and of course there's no timeline for this kind of rulemaking, so we also couldn't predict how long it would take to get it through the process, but you know, we're talking months, not weeks.
Anyone else on the council? Maggie?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maggie Raymond, Associated Fisheries of Maine. Pat, I was wondering, first I wanted to thank you for responding positively to the council's request that you look at a possible increase in the Whitehake and Georges Bank winter flounder trip limits for, during the interim rule. And I was wondering if you could tell me when you think that decision might be made and then what would be the earliest in the fishing year when an increase could be implemented if that were deemed to be warranted?
It would be a similar answer to the last question. No timeline for it, although this is clearly a lot more straightforward than the herring action would be, and I believe would be it would be a revision to the final rule, so of course we wouldn't be doing proposed final rule. So in this case, I think I'd say that we're talking weeks, not months.
Okay. Anything else for Pat? Okay. Moving on to NOAA General Counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll just bring you up to date on our litigation. As I'm sure you're aware, with respect to the challenge to Framework 42, very shortly after the last council meeting concluded, the government submitted its report concerning the analysis of the mixed stock exception, which was under which the plaintiffs had challenged the agency on whether that exception was considered sufficiently in our approval and implementation of Framework 42. And I think on Friday, the day after the council meeting, the court issued an opinion immediately saying that we had complied with its order and to seriously consider and analyze the mixed stock exception. And the court also granted our motion for summary judgment on that count, thereby finding in favor of the government on both of the counts that were addressed in the litigation. The court in that order left open the possibility that the other counts that the plaintiffs had sued the agency on would still be under consideration. However, the government filed in its report, and I think subsequently we notified the court that the interim rule was about to be implemented as of May 1st which rendered all counts and the litigation in Framework 42 moot. And the court, on or about May 1st, agreed with that argument on the part of the government and eventually dismissed the entire lawsuit. And on the two substantive issues found in favor of the government. We've gotten, as far as I know, only one lawsuit challenging our interim rule. Sometimes we don't know until after a lawsuit is filed because of delays in service of the lawsuit on the agency. But to date, the only one that I'm aware of was filed by a group of mostly New Jersey fishermen and some New York fishermen. The lead name is James Lovegren. And there are several counts that the plaintiffs brought in challenge of Framework 42. Now, briefly summarize those so you know what the nature of the counts are. The first count is that the interim rule violates Amendment 5 to the Constitution, which states that there shall not be a person should not be deprived of property without due process of law. You know, the basic claim here is, of course, that by the actions and the regulations included in the regulation in the interim rule, that somehow plaintiffs have been deprived of property. They sued on several Magnuson-Stevens Act claims. The first is that under National Standard 2, that which requires management measures to be based upon the best scientific information available, that this was not done primarily because the NIMS database used for landings data, among other purposes, is incomplete and contains numerous errors. I'm reading the allegations of the plaintiff here. They also allege a claim based on National Standard 4, which is the one that requires fairness and equity in management measures, as well as that a requirement that conservation and management measures shall not discriminate between residents of different states. Here the plaintiffs, and this is a theme that runs throughout the complaint, claim that the fishermen in the South, like the New Jersey, New York fishermen, were not adequately represented on the advisory panel nor on the councils, and therefore the impacts of this interim rule unfairly affected the fishermen to the south of New England. There's also a count based on National Standard 6, which basically says that management measures shall take into account and allow for variations among and contingencies in fisheries, fishery resources, and catches. Similar claim is made that the New Jersey and New York fishing communities and the impact of this rule on those communities was not adequately considered, and therefore it was not fair and equitable with respect to the impacts on those communities. There's a National Standard 8 challenge. National Standard 8 requires that measures shall be consistent with conservation requirements and take into account the importance of fishery resources to fishing communities. Again, the plaintiffs allege that New Jersey and New York were not adequately represented and the impacts of the rule were not adequately considered in light of New Jersey and New York fishing communities. There's also a National Standard 9 claim. National Standard 9 requires bycatch to be minimized to the extent practicable. The plaintiffs aver that the rule does not minimize bycatch of winter flounder or other species and increases mortality of winter flounder and other species through regulatory discards for the New Jersey and New York fishing communities. There's a general claim, again following this theme, that New York and New Jersey weren't adequately represented, that the council is made up of unfairly does not have sufficient representation of New York and New Jersey. It also claims that the regional administrator, who's a member of the New England Council as well as its executive committee, is in a conflict of interest because those committees pick the advisory panel, and somehow that's a violation of of general requirements under the Madison-Stevens Act, and that there's been a failure to adequately conduct meaningful public hearings in the geographical area represented by the plaintiffs. And there's also a claim that the Mid-Atlantic Council did not adequately represent the New York and New Jersey fishermen with respect to this rule. Then there's a general NEPA challenge that NEPA was not adequately complied with, and also that the Regulatory Flexibility Act was not complied with. And after all of that, there's some somewhat unusual prayers for relief. The prayer for relief is what the plaintiffs hope to get out of the litigation. And the request for relief is, one, that the Secretary seriously evaluate whether negotiated rulemaking is appropriate pursuant to the Negotiated Rulemaking Act. Two, that the Secretary can seriously evaluate whether negotiated rulemaking is appropriate pursuant to the Fishery Negotiation Panel, which is provided for in our national guidelines. That there just be a declaratory judgment that the government has violated the Madison-Stevens Act, and an award for attorney's fees. And there is not a prayer to set aside the rule, which you would normally see in these kinds of lawsuits. So that is a summary of the what appears to be the one and only challenge to the interim rule. And let me just bring you up to date on some of the other, at least three other lawsuits that we're involved in. In the Mid-Coast lawsuit, which is a challenge to our denial of a request for rulemaking to closed groundfish closed areas to herring midwater trawlers, both the plaintiffs and the agency have filed our motions for summary judgment in that case. The schedule calls for reply motions by each party to the other motion for summary judgment. And those reply motions have not yet been filed, but I believe the plaintiffs is due within a week or so, and then we have one due within a few weeks after that. In the lawsuit challenging Amendment 11 to the Scallop FMP, the plaintiffs and defendants, the government, have filed their motions for summary judgment in that lawsuit, and we're awaiting the reply, each of our reply motions back and forth. Those are not yet due, but will soon be completed within the next month, I believe. In the challenge by Oceana to the standard bycatch reporting methodology amendment, we're still litigating or disputing, or the plaintiffs are still disputing the completeness of our administrative record in that case. A judge, a magistrate, who is a sort of a sub-judge appointed by the head or by the federal court judge that's in charge of litigation, found in the initial challenge to the administrative record that our administrative record is compliant with legal requirements, and the plaintiff, Oceana, is challenging that finding of the magistrate judge. You're allowed to, a plaintiff or someone who has lost an issue at the magistrate judge level is allowed to object to the magistrate's findings with regards to an issue, in this case, the completeness of the record. And so that challenge is something that we're going to have to reply to within the next week or so. Brings us up to date on litigation. I have nothing else to report, Mr. Chairman.
Frank?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gene, see how they're not asking for a lot in the, well, maybe it doesn't seem like a lot, in the interim rule lawsuit. If the court found in their favor, is that something they're going to use to try and get a seat on the New England Council? Or is that their objective?
I have no idea what their objective is. I mean, these are private fishermen. There'd have to be a change in the statute, so they're free to lobby for that, I presume. But the fact that a court reaches a certain finding regarding the issues here would not necessarily mean that they would be entitled to a seat.
Anything further for Gene? Thanks, Gene. Okay, moving on. Nancy or Dr. Jim for the Science Center.
Thank you. Nancy gave me the go-ahead, so I'll give a report on survey activities and then an update on stock assessment meetings. For the 2009 bottom trawl survey, I'd like to report that there's been a doubling of the sampling effort in offshore strata that are over 110 meters and deeper. And this is intended to collect more and better data on fish stocks that are living in deeper water offshore that weren't sampled as completely with the previous survey by the albatross. And as a result of this doubling of sampling effort offshore, the total survey time for both the spring and the fall survey has been extended from 48 sea days to 60 sea days. And the survey that was just completed had approximately 20% more stations As a result of this increased sampling and the larger catches that the Bigelow takes in many cases, we're also getting a big increase in the number of age samples that are collected. For the monkfish survey, that was completed on June the 6th. That was a cooperative survey, and the fishing vessel Mary Kay and fishing vessel Endurance participated in that survey. For the sea scallop dredge survey, the 2009 sea scallop survey is currently in progress on the RV Hugh Sharp, and this survey will be completed on July the 3rd. The survey is coordinating with two RSA-funded projects, one with the Virginia Institute of Marine Science, which is doing shadow tows with a commercial vessel, and another project with the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute with the HABCAM instrument. Moving on to stock assessment, the SARC 48 meeting took place the first week of June at the Woods Hole Laboratory, and the three species were on the SARC for peer review: ocean quahogs, tilefish, and weakfish. The center is also involved with annual updates of most of the mid-Atlantic stocks, such as bluefish, black sea bass, scup, etc. There will be a vessel calibration meeting in Woods Hole to review the data that have been collected between the Bigelow and the Albatross, and that meeting will take place the week of August the 10th. There have been a track meeting was recently completed in St. Andrews, Canada, on Eastern Georges Bank cod, Eastern Georges Bank haddock, and Georges Bank yellowtail, as well as herring. And I believe those reports are out, and the various PDTs will be discussing those reports in their upcoming meetings. When the council would like to have a presentation by someone at the Science Center, we can arrange to have a scientist come up and present those, a summary of those outcomes to you if you would like. There's a track mackerel data meeting scheduled for August the 18th and 19th. And on just last week, June 16th through 18th, we had a meeting on wolffish at the Science Center. And this was a status review related to the Endangered Species Act. And I believe that a report from that meeting will be coming out in 2 to 3 weeks. Moving on towards next fall, the SARC 49, which will take place, I believe, the first week in December, will have two stocks, Atlantic surf clam and butterfish. And then there are track meetings. Final dates have not been scheduled yet, but for dogfish and mackerel, those both have meetings coming up in the track sometime around December. And then finally, for June of 2010, on SARC 50, the schedule includes sea scallop and monkfish on the SARC. That concludes my report. Thank you.
Nancy.
Yeah, thank you. I just have one more thing to add, and Jim hasn't really been that much involved in it, but I have. The announcement came out last week that we've selected the Cooperative Institute for the North Atlantic. The acronym is CNAR, Cooperative Institute North Atlantic Region, and I think everybody's probably seen it by now, but the main host institution is HUI and includes GMRI, University of Maine, Rutgers, and Maryland. And so obviously we're in the process now of talking with those folks and getting them up to speed.
Dave Gates.
Jim, you mentioned that you're picking up quite a few more numbers of fish in the survey tow, so you've been able to get a lot more age samples. How many are necessary in general to be able to do the modeling that you need to do? And the reason I'm asking is because we potentially now may have four species with zero retention in the commercial and recreational catch. And it's been my understanding that most of the age samples came from port sampling, which you will no longer have. So are you going to be able to get sufficient samples of wolffish and windowpane and southern New England winter flounder and ocean pout to be able to run your models?
Well, that I don't think I can answer your question specifically. That's something that the actual data analysts would have to. I can carry that question back to them, but I do have a list of that, which just indicates that there have been significant increases in the number of age samples that have been collected. And the increases are on the order of anywhere from about 50% up to approximately 300%. So other than telling you we have a lot more samples collected, I can't specifically tell you how they'll play into the modeling. We'll have to see what's needed for each stock and how the data are used.
Okay. It might be handy to have that information before the groundfish votes because, if we don't have sufficient numbers of fish sampled for you to be able to do the work you need to do, we're going to have to set up some mechanism to get those fish so that you'll have the information you need. Otherwise, we'll never know what the status of the stock is. So what I'm thinking of specifically is wolffish and some of these other ones that they're potentially saying throw it all back, because I think we may need a small research catch or something to get you the information you need.
Paul Howard.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Jim, it was probably a year or so ago or longer, the council expressed concern about the lack of calibration time and things like this. And also one concern was with the Bigelow that the nearshore stocks, especially in the Gulf of Maine, would not be sampled like in the past because of the deeper draft of the Bigelow. So what is being done about the inshore, nearshore stations that the Bigelow doesn't do? And is the surveys now a little bit more the calibration a little more complicated now by adding additional stations offshore? It's two questions.
Yeah, the answer to the first one is for the southern areas, the NEMAP survey is taking care of the inshore strata. And as far as I know, we have state surveys along the New England coast, which are continuing, which will be used. The answer to the second question about the increased sampling offshore, that doesn't complicate the analysis because we haven't changed the strata that are sampled. So we've simply added the number of stations to the offshore strata. so we'll simply have more precise estimates of what's out there.
More questions for Jim or Nancy? Okay. Thanks, Jim. Thanks, Nancy. Moving on, Mid-Atlantic.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mid-Atlantic Council met 2 weeks ago in New York. They will be moving ahead with scoping to the Dogfish Amendment. Scoping should start taking place the end of July, first part in August. We'll have two meetings in the northern area, probably one in the New Bedford area, and one north of Boston. Times to be announced later. They set the mackerel, butterfish, Elex squid, surf clam, and ocean call hogs specs at this meeting. They were all rolled over. They asked for they sent a letter to the Department of Commerce asking for more observer coverage in the small mesh fisheries, and that was basically about it. A few other things.
Terry?
Oh, they're the monkfish.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. They also accepted the monkfish committee's recommendation for Amendment 5.
Erling, anything you want to add?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The only thing I can add is that the council, the Mid-Atlantic Council, is meeting July 14th in Philadelphia to take up the ACLs and the AM issues.
As I understand, I've spoken with your chair, Rick Robbins. That's an all-day meeting where the committees are going to meet one after another, but it's a full council meeting?
Yes, that's correct. All day.
Okay. Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, Frank, was there any discussion about limited access in the mackerel fishery and the progress the council has made to date on that?
I don't think there was at the last meeting there was, but not at this one. I don't recall it at this meeting.
Anything further under Mid-Atlantic issues? Sally?
Yeah, the letter that's going to the Commerce Secretary on observer coverage, was that largely in parallel to the letter that went from ASMFC to the Secretary? Was it designed to kind of be working in concert there? I'm just trying to kind of understand what these other bodies are doing on monitoring of small mesh fisheries as we're dealing with that ourselves and kind of getting little signals from ASMFC and then from the MID. Can you give any more detail on that? Do we have that letter yet?
I don't believe we have the letter yet. I don't know if someone that attended the meeting wants to discuss what's likely to be in the letter.
No. Yeah, I don't think they it was going to be written by Rick and then to Dan. There wasn't that much discussion.
Okay. And as I said, Sally, we're going to bring that up under hearing on our agenda tomorrow. Anything further on Mid-Atlantic issues? Seeing none, we'll move along. U.S. Coast Guard.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to start today by taking the opportunity to do a couple of introductions. We've got some new folks here in the room. Behind me is Commander Pete DeCola. Pete's going to be joining the enforcement staff this summer. Pete's been all around New England over his Coast Guard career, both afloat and ashore. He brings a lot of talent, and I think you'll find a great sense of humor to the job, and we really are looking forward to him joining us. Regretfully, the reason he's joining us is that EJ's leaving. Many of you have had the opportunity to work with EJ Marone over the last couple of years, and he'll be finishing his tour in New England and moving on to Sector Detroit this summer. Now, some people may be thinking, Detroit, ooh, who'd EJ tick off? It's a great assignment and a reflection of the great work he's done here with us in the last couple of years. Whether you know it or not, the state with the largest amount of coastline in the U.S. is Alaska, right? And the number two state is Michigan. But the state with the highest number of registered recreational boats anywhere is Michigan. Is a huge business line for the Coast Guard out there. There's more commerce flowing down the Detroit River, deadweight tonnage of commerce, than there is flowing through the Panama Canal. So it's a real busy place, and EJ being assigned out there is a real testament to the good work he's done. We wish him good luck, and thanks for all your help you've been to me, EJ, so good luck. completing the fire triangle, covering the room from that corner over there, Captain John Healy. John's our new sector commander in Boston, and he wanted to come up here with us today just to see a Fisheries Council, see what it's all about, get a feeling for the process, and welcome aboard John. He's a lifelong New Englander, lifelong Massachusetts guy. There's some questions that the last couple of years he spent down in Detroit may have somewhat contaminated the sports bloodlines, but we think after a few years here in Boston, sort of a Red Sox, Patriots dialysis, if you will, we'll get them clean again and certified. So welcome to you, John, and thanks for coming up to see a fish meeting with us. I've got two things to talk about today, the enforcement report, the regular enforcement report, and then I want to talk a little bit about the Patriot SAR case from last January. Enforcement-wise, we did 320 boardings. This is between April and June 1st. Of the 320 we did, we found fisheries violations on 13 boats, so that equates to 4%. So 96% observed compliance, still pretty good out there. Not so good on the safety side. We're finding 80 of the 320 boats we boarded had safety problems. That's 25% non-compliance out there. Everything from simple flares being past a date to hydrostatic releases on survival craft, hydrostatic releases on EPIRBs, one boat without any fire extinguishers at all, and a lot of survival suit problems out there. Five commercial fishing vessel voyages were terminated. Interestingly, they were all up here in Maine for some reason. I don't know what that means yet. I haven't really had a chance to look into that, but they were all in Maine. Safety-wise, 295 boats applied for safety decals, and 227 got them issued. So that's 77% of the boats showing up and asking for a safety inspection or passing that safety inspection. About the same thing we see at sea. 37 vessel casualties during this period. 10 of them were equipment casualties, an engine or a transmission or a generator or something. 9 vessels were reported running aground. 9 vessels ran aground. 5 vessels flooded. 3 vessels reported collisions and elisions. Actually, I guess 2 were in a collision and 1 was in an elision, right? I don't think it was 3 boats at the same time. So 2 in a collision and 1 in an elision. And 3 vessels had onboard fires and 1 vessel had a man overboard. 3 vessels sank during the period. 2 were underway in fishing and the other one sank at its moorings with no one on board. 20 lives were saved during the period, and this is April and May. And we conducted 7 medevac or medico cases helping injured people at sea. Next, we're going to go on and talk a little bit about the Patriot case here. This isn't the marine casualty case, folks. This is our internal view into the Coast Guard search and rescue response to this particular fishing vessel loss. I want to briefly cover the information provided in the Coast Guard's final action memo pertaining to the 3 January 2009 search and rescue case involving the loss of the fishing vessel Patriot, Mr. Matteo Russo and Mr. John Orlando. 4 parts to the presentation is an overview, is the facts of the case, opinions developed as a result of the investigation, changes that have been made, and changes that may be made in the future. Based on the best information available at this time, it appears that sometime between 1:17 and 1:30 a.m., January 3rd, the fishing vessel Patriot, a 54-foot commercial fishing vessel with 2 persons on board, sank approximately 14 miles southeast of Gloucester. Coast Guard search and rescue resources from Station Gloucester, Point Allerton, Sector Boston, Air Station Cape Cod, the Coast Guard Cutter Flying Fish, and the 1st District responded. The search effort located a debris field and the deceased crew members within the assigned search area. Neither crew member was found to be wearing survival gear or flotation gear. The death certificates issued by the Commonwealth of Massachusetts Medical Examiner's Office indicate that the victim's deaths were due to drowning, quote, within seconds, unquote, of entering the water. No traditional distress signal was received from the Patriot before the vessel sank or prior to the launch of Coast Guard assets. This case was initiated by a call from the co-owner of the Patriot, Mrs. Josie Russo, at 1:35 a.m. to Station Gloucester after she was notified that a fire alarm installed on the vessel for in-port remote monitoring had gone off. Situational ambiguity regarding the condition and location of the vessel made it particularly difficult to process the SAR case. The Coast Guard's response in launching SAR assets was delayed due to poor collection and analysis of information and decision-making regarding the vessel status. After 2 hours and 23 minutes of fact-finding and analysis of information by the station, the sector, and the district watchstanders to ascertain the nature of the distress, Coast Guard assets were ordered launched. The cause of the sudden loss of the Patriot is being studied and assessed in a separate Coast Guard marine casualty investigation. The separate process is in accordance with Marine Casualty and Investigation Manual. Neither victim was recovered with any survival gear, and no distress signals were made, indicating that the Patriot sank quickly with little advance warning. With the medical examiner's opinion that neither victim appeared to have suffered from hypothermia before drowning, and that drowning occurred within seconds, it appears likely that their deaths occurred before Station Gloucester was first informed of the fire alarm at 1:35 a.m. In light of this, even if there had been perfect data collection and an immediate launch of SAR assets, the Coast Guard could not have prevented the tragic loss, Mr. Russo and Mr. Orlando. Nonetheless, the Coast Guard's response to this incident was, we feel, inefficient and revealed several procedural training and judgment shortfalls. At the onset, the Coast Guard's response to the sinking of the Patriot was beset with inefficient information flow and processing at the sector and station level, which ultimately led to a delayed launch of search units. These issues combined to hamper the responder's ability to fully understand the aggregate picture and thus develop a higher sense of urgency earlier in the case. It took a relatively long period of time to move from the alert stage to the distress stage, or to conclude there existed the potential for distress which would require the launch of search units. This case was particularly difficult to process and classify as one involving distress or the potential for distress, because the usual indications of distress were not present until search units arrived on scene. Nonetheless, numerous actions, if done sooner, could have led to increased situational awareness and an ability to better assess the situation. These actions include issuing an urgent marine information broadcast, obtaining VMS positions, and notifying senior members of the SAR response chain. The First District Command Center should have assumed SAR mission coordinator. While not changing the ultimate outcome, a more assertive direction from the First District Command Center may have led to an earlier launch of response assets. So what are we doing to make sure this doesn't happen again? Forcing mechanisms in Sector Boston standing order. CO Sector Boston is here today, and since this case at Sector Boston, they've implemented what we call forcing mechanisms into their search and rescue standing orders, whereby before we had a culture that said, okay, if you're starting to wonder what's going on, you need to talk to the chain of command. Now we have it in writing. Now, within 10 minutes of starting a SAR case, the sector duty personnel have to inform the chain of command. Policy changes. In February, E.J. Marone wrote a new VMS policy use and promulgated it as a First District instruction for all the First District units. That First District message was adopted by headquarters, and a new national VMS use policy was promulgated and put out. Remember, though, VMS and SAR, I hate talking about the two things in the same sentence, but I'll say it once again. The caution, the bottom line, VMS is not a SAR alerting system. You recall that the research that the First District and NOAA's New England Regional Office here did to see whether or not VMS would be suitable as a SAR alerting system. And we ran a whole bunch of numbers about maybe 18 months ago now. And what we concluded from those numbers was that if we were to use VMS as a SAR alerting system, and we were to choose the six-hour interval, in other words, the boat had disappeared off the screen for 6 hours when we decided to take action, If we waited 6 hours, that would create 3,000 false maydays a year in the first district alone. That's because of data latency. That's what's in the VMS system. The data is accurate. When it shows up, you can believe in it, but it doesn't necessarily show up on time. And that's why VMS is not suitable as a SAR alerting system. So please, when you talk to people and they talk about VMS changes that have been made as a result of the Patriot, it doesn't turn it into a SAR alerting system. A few other changes that will be made Coast Guard-wide. Right now, with regards to VMS, we have sort of employment standards out there, training objectives that are out there. I mean, they're going to be formalized into PQS, which is called a professional qualification standard. Atlantic Area Operations Division will direct all districts to task sectors with the responsibility to review their standing orders to ensure currency of the commander's intent and guidance. The Operations Division in Atlantic Area is going to forward a copy of the investigation to the Coast Guard Office of Search and Rescue and the National Search and Rescue School to share the lessons learned from the Patriot, not only nationwide, but also internationally. And all Atlantic Area District Commanders are going to review the findings, opinions, and actions in this SAR review case with all their command center personnel and command cadre. This week, Admiral Gable, the 1st District Commander, is traveling around to his 5 sectors. He's meeting with all of his search and rescue personnel and going over the findings in this case. Next slide, Tim. A quote from our commandant, "Transparency and self-assessment breed self-correcting behaviors." That's what we hope to be achieving here. We have and will continue to conduct honest self-assessments to achieve search and rescue mission excellence. Please remember that safety at sea is a partnership and that mariners and fishermen are most often able to most highly affect their own safety. Loss of life does not have to be an accepted part of commercial fishing. What can fishermen do? No new lessons here, folks. Continue to foster a culture of safety. There's been a lot of progress made in the last 20 years in New England, and there's lots of room to go. Know your boat. In particular, know the stability limits of your boat. Know the stability and safe operating limits. Know your crew. Train them. Ensure that adequate people are on board to meet emergency situations. And maintain your material condition. Practice emergency procedures. While we haven't concluded our investigation into why the Patriot sank, by all indications, it sank quickly. Everyone on board needs to know how to respond to emergencies. Masters may not have time to instruct the crew when the emergency happens. People have to already know what to do. Use the Global Maritime Distress and Safety System. That is your EPIRB, your FM and AM radios, digital selective calling, and in MARSAT if you have that. To activate the SAR system, go back to GMDSS. Don't be looking to VMS to activate a SAR case. Go to one of your components of the GMDSS system, right? The EPIRB or the radio are the big ones. And lastly, survive that period until help arrives. Plan for the worst-case scenario and know that we're not going to be there instantaneously. It may take minutes. It may take hours for us to arrive, and you have to survive in that period until we can get there. I appreciate the Council's patience and support during our SAR case analysis. The 1st District alone carried out 3,200 cases last year, and we saved 414 lives. We saved or assisted more than $200 million in property. Now, although that SAR case system works well, it isn't flawless. And that's why we conduct case studies analysis like this one. We've got to carefully analyze root causes of performance anomalies before changing our systems. We want to ensure any changes we make will have positive, known effects, and we want to avoid any unintended consequences. We believe we've achieved this, improvements without unintended consequences. There's a couple of websites there if you'd like further information on the Patriot case. The top one is the Commander of Atlantic Area's final action memo right there. You can go get the whole thing and read it yourself. That's a timeline and all of his opinions and all of the things, warts and hairs there that the service is going to do internally to make sure that we're making improvements. The second is our proposed fish and vessel safety regulations. If you haven't taken the time to read those and you know what the Coast Guard's proposing, I'd ask you to do it and maybe even to write some support into the docket. And the third is FishSafe.org that I know everybody's familiar with, but it's always got good information there. Thanks, Mr. Chairman. If there's any questions on Patriot, I'll try and take them.
Thanks, Joe. Questions for Joe? Dick Gaethel.
Yeah, Joe, first of all, I want to thank you for the forthright and plain-spoken discussion of the Patriot situation, especially by your admiral who's issued a statement, I think, last week that was picked up and published quite widely. People I've talked to in the fishing community are grateful that there's been transparency and that there's been, you know, that the situation's being seriously assessed so that even though we couldn't save these people, hopefully it'll lead to some changes. It might save somebody else. You mentioned this situation with situational awareness, that people will be brought in now earlier that have greater situational awareness. Does that mean basically senior commanders, people with more search and rescue experience? Could you explain that a little bit to the public so they understand what you meant by that?
You bet. When you're talking to the Coast Guard, you're not necessarily talking to the most experienced person on watch. If you're calling in on the radio, you're calling in on the telephone, you've got the duty watch stander, and they begin a search and rescue case. At some point, now, we worked 3,200 SAR cases last year, and not one of them was alike, right? Not one of them's alike. So part of that job description of being a search and rescue controller is at some point applying some judgment as to what's going on. Sometimes you get you get somebody calling you on, and the radio tells you exactly who they are, exactly where they are, exactly what the problem is, and exactly the help they need, and that's great. You're off and running in about 3 minutes after the radio call. And sometimes you get, like we had with the Patriot, just an oddball phone call. Gee, the in-port alarm went off. I don't know what that means. We don't know what that means. It's the in-port alarm, but the boat's not in port. Okay, where's the boat? Is it a regular dock? Is it some other dock in port? If it's not in port, where was it? It takes a long time to put all those things together. The forcing mechanisms that we talked about require the junior folks who are working their first SAR cases to get the senior folks that have better judgment involved earlier. At some point in this case, there was a couple of phone calls made to the right senior people who said, why are you calling me? You haven't launched yet? Launch and then call me. Well, why wasn't that person brought in a lot earlier? Well, when we went back and looked at our own rules for running these SAR cases, there was no forcing mechanism to require it. It was a culture that required it, but that's different than a forcing mechanism. So now we've got some rules in place to make those phone calls earlier, make sure that senior people with that judgment are watching these cases be developed earlier on. Did I answer your question?
Yep.
Thanks.
Any other questions for Joe? Okay. Well, EJ, good luck to you. Funny guy, Pete. You got something to live up to. You're going to need to make us laugh. We could use it around here. And John, welcome. Welcome aboard. Look forward to seeing you from time to time, although it sounds like you're going to be busy. Okay. Thank you. Okay, moving on. NIMS Enforcement, VMS.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, everybody. Good to see everyone again. I want to kick off the enforcement report this morning with a very serious topic. For the fifth time this year, a council member's safety was threatened. We've had several in New England. We've had several in Mid-Atlantic. To my knowledge, this has not occurred in other councils around the country. I just want to make you aware of that. I want you to know that I think that it is unacceptable behavior. I recognize that council members do a very difficult job, sometimes a controversial job, and I think everyone else needs to recognize that also. Disagreeing is one thing. Threatening somebody is something else entirely. I'd also like to urge you that if you feel threatened, you are threatened. There's no definition, really. It's what you feel. And if you do feel threatened, your first line of defense is 911. Please call the local police. Please call the state police. I would like to be made aware of it. I will counsel you and guide you if I can, but your first line of defense are the local authorities. In the case last week, we now have police agencies in three states involved. I don't know what the outcome will be. I know that it did not result in violence, which is a good thing, but we as a group can't tolerate that kind of behavior. Next, I would like to address the upcoming Office of Inspector General investigation of the Office of Law Enforcement and the Office of General Counsel. The Secretary of Commerce, through Dr. Lubchenco, has asked the OIG to come in and look at our program again, as they did last year, nationwide. And I think that this is a really good step. I think it's an opportunity for the OIG, who is an objective, independent branch of the government, to come in and scrutinize what we do. I welcome it. I expect that they're going to give us a clean bill of health, and I hope that they give us some suggestions to help us provide even better service than we do. Now, I don't know if anyone on the council will be contacted by the Inspector General. If you are, I would urge you to cooperate with them and urge you to give them whatever information they request. If you have a feeling about how we operate in law enforcement and general counsel, I would encourage you to discuss that with them. I want to discuss several cases this morning. The state of New Jersey and NOAA agents seized over 22,000 pounds of scallops that were valued at over $152,000 from a vessel that attempted to conceal the illegal overage. That is currently being investigated. I anticipate charges will be filed in that. In a similar case that you've probably heard about, overages of scallops from general category boats, I believe, maybe a limited access boat also, were surreptitiously trucked from New Jersey right up here to Maine. That case has been ongoing for a while, and I hope that it would have been wrapped up by now, but as often happens with these cases, the deeper we dig, the more there is. So we've uncovered some more events that we suspect are violations. So we're not going to move forward with anything until all that's been completed. During this period, we issued one summary settlement for four consecutive VMS miscodings in a week. Now, we realize that there are over 200 VMS codes right now, and it is admittedly a difficult thing to comply with if you're unfamiliar. Our standard procedure is to notify the boat and or to call the boat back to port so they can put in the correct code and start over again. We like to do that because it encourages compliance, and it's a very low-level approach to setting things right. But when we have a case like this four times in 1 week and people just aren't getting the message, and therefore we're not getting the information that you all need as managers, we will prosecute. So that case resulted in a summary settlement being issued. We issued a four-count violation to a Cape May company for herring violations in which their 2009 harvest was misreported by 20%. That equals about 4 million pounds. And, of course, in a quota fishery, 4 million pounds in one shot can have a serious impact. So we will continue to monitor the herring issues as closely as we can. Just last week, agents in Boston and Quincy executed four simultaneous search warrants in businesses and buildings associated with an outfit that was importing falsely labeled catfish from Vietnam. And you've heard me talk about some of those cases in the past. The case that resulted in the search warrant, again, involved falsely labeled fish that was being illegally imported and marketed as domestic snapper, grouper, yellowtail, and other species, which directly impacts domestic fisheries and the market. In a related, but in a similar, but an unrelated case, on May 18th, a fellow named Peter Lamb, in the Virginia Star catfish case, was sentenced to 63 months in federal prison for conspiracy and smuggling of catfish. 63 months tells you how serious a crime that was. You are all aware of the NOAA ship strike of a right whale. The NOAA research vessel AUK struck a right whale. I know that that case is under some scrutiny from the industry because of two other endangered species and marine mammal takes that occurred that are being prosecuted. I had hoped at this point that investigation would be completed. I'd ask you to have a little more patience, continued patience with us. One of the key witnesses was out of the country for a while. That person has returned, and I expect that case will be wrapped up very quickly. On Friday, the agency announced that the Gloucester Seafood Display Auction would have to serve a 10-day permit sanction sometime in the near future as a result of a year 2000 misreporting case involving cod. That case was settled by the auction in the Office of General Counsel in 2003, and part of the settlement agreement was that 10 days of the sanction would be suspended if the auction had no other violations within a certain period of time. In fact, the auction did violate again, and this is kind of a contractual agreement between the business and general counsel. The auction appealed that decision, and on April 1st, the administrator upheld general counsel's sanction, and now the auction will have to stop handling federally regulated species for a period of 10 days. And finally, on VMS, Bill Semro is not here today. On July 28th through 30th, Office of Law Enforcement Headquarters is sponsoring a VMS workshop down by Dulles Airport. It's not really geared for council members. It's geared more for end users. However, if any of you want to attend July 28th through 30th, let me know and I'll give you the information. And I've been asked to pass on it. You're welcome to do that. That concludes my report.
Thanks, Andy. Questions for Andy? Dr. Pierce.
Andy, regarding the Gloucester auction, you indicated that the 10-day sanction would occur because there was a second violation. Do you have any details regarding the nature of that second violation?
I have Chuck Julian here with me today, and he can address that. Chuck is a senior enforcement attorney in the Office of General Counsel for Enforcement and Litigation. And Chuck's going to field any specific case-related questions.
Hi. Originally, there was a settlement agreement with Mitch McDonald in my office, and Andy described that properly. They were on a one-year probation, the auction was. 5 months into that probation period, they were caught with an overage in their facility. And they were found with a tally sheet that said 500 pounds, and in fact, when the fish was weighed, it was 575 pounds. So it was more of the same, quite frankly. They didn't make it through their one-year probation. They initially paid $80,000 and were given a 15-day sanction, and 10 days of which were suspended because they had created false documentation to hide overages. Cod overages. Within 5 months, they were still hiding cod overages. We've heard much about the one fish case. Well, it really wasn't one fish. It was about 80-something pounds of fish, but after we rounded it all down, it came to 75 pounds. So what happened was I charged them with maintaining a false document under our regulations. I gave them a fine. We went through the whole process. Initially, I lost the case before Judge Fitzpatrick because the judge had erred by finding that a tally sheet was not a record that the agency would want to have, and a tally sheet is the best evidence of what's actually landed. And I'm talking about what the guy who's looking at the digital scale writes down. A tally sheet's the best evidence of what's landed. Okay? So the judge erred in finding that the tally sheet in the particular case was some sort of preliminary document. He bought their argument. I appealed it to the no administrator, who bought my argument. But of course the tally sheet is very important. Of course we want a tally sheet. And of course you can't write 500 pounds on a tally sheet if you've got 575 pounds of fish. So that lower decision was reversed. That was appealed through the administrative process again, which is the right of the auction. And on April 1st, the decision was upheld. Now, the decision actually went back to the judge. The judge, the original judge, Fitzpatrick, had retired. It went to a Judge Devine, who decided to lower the penalty that I had assessed to $10,000 in 20 days. I had asked for $120,000 in 90 days. Because this, in my mind, this was a continuation of more illegal behavior, and they were encouraging people to land overages. And if we looked at the auction's own records, you could see that there were hundreds and hundreds of landings that were precisely 500 pounds. There were a bunch of landings, 498, 499. There weren't any 502s or 510s. It seemed very odd to me. And then we sort of caught them with a hand in the cookie jar in that one case. So I thought it was very serious. I thought the fact that an $80,000 penalty and a suspended penalty didn't do the trick, that more draconian measures were required. So I fought the case. We went back and forth. On April 1st, the administrative NOAA decided 10,000 is what it is, and in 20 days suspended. They have since appealed that. The auction has appealed that to U.S. District Court. Now, the settlement agreement that Mitch wrote that was entered into with the auction, who had counsel, I think Stephen Ouellette at the time, said that if they were to get a subsequent violation within a year, a subsequent serious violation, then they would owe us the 10 days. Subsequent serious violation was defined as something that resulted in a fine of $10,000 or more, and that was a final agency decision. On April 1st, there was a final agency decision that they owed us the $10,000, which automatically kicked in the provision of Mitch's settlement agreement. So they were recently notified that they ought to serve the 10 days and then move on. So the I think that describes what's been called the one fish case.
Terry?
Yeah, thank you, Andy, for reporting what you can on the Maine and New Jersey scallop case. There are a large number of people in the state that are paying attention to that case, and your continued investigation is very much appreciated.
Mary Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Andy, on the herring, the company in New Jersey that misreported herring, could you provide a little extra detail? Reporting of herring is something we're looking at in the current amendment, and I was just curious what misreporting meant.
Yes, give me just a sec. I can certainly get you more details later, Mary Beth, but what I can tell you now is we issued a four-count violation enforcement action report to the owner and operator of a herring vessel based out of Cape May. An audit of the vessel's reporting revealed that they have underreported the 2009 harvest by 20%, which is approximately 4 million pounds.
Anything further? Thank you. ASMFC. Hold on, Bob. Dr. Pierce, did you want to talk about enforcement, or you want to let Bob talk about ASMFC?
I didn't realize Bob was here.
Bob's here. Bob?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Pierce wants to go. I'll let him. But first, let me start off by saying Vince apologizes for not being here. He's up in Alaska right now. I think he may have caught wind of your pending travel policy that you just approved and didn't want to cause any problems.
What a beer.
There's a full summary of the last ASMFC meeting behind tab number 2 in the briefing materials. I won't go into all the details. A couple highlights that are relevant to the actions of the New England, or relevant to the species within, under the purview of the New England Council. The Commission did approve Amendment 2 to the River Herring FMP. This included a provision that all states must close their in-river harvest of river herring fisheries if they can't prove those harvests or those fisheries are sustainable. So for the next year or so, the states are going to be developing programs and metrics to determine if their in-river harvest of river herring is sustainable. If it's not and they can't provide evidence to the commission that it is a sustainable fishery, then that state will be obligated to close all in-river harvests. So it'll be a complete closure potentially for a number of states. As has been talked about a couple times earlier, the Commission did send a letter to the Secretary of Commerce requesting emergency action for river herring data collection in particular. There's a lot of concern at ASMSC over the small mesh or the bycatch that's occurring in small mesh fisheries up and down the Atlantic coast outside the authority of the ASMSC. Based on the data that is available now, there appears to be some hot spots and some problems in a number of small mesh fisheries, but it is preliminary data, and the Commission wants to seek ways to find funding and resources to collect that additional data. The second part of that letter that we sent to the Secretary requested that the Secretary support actions pending actions by the New England Council in particular. The assumption was Amendment 4 was going to move forward with the monitoring programs, data collection programs. I think the committee took action earlier this month to possibly separate out the monitoring provisions from the ACLAM provisions, but nevertheless, the Commission would like to see increased sampling and coverage and data collection efforts for small mesh fisheries up and down the coast. As Frank mentioned earlier, the Mid-Atlantic Council did also approve a motion to send a letter to the Secretary of Commerce. And I've had some email discussions with Rick Robbins that the intention of that letter was to support, essentially lend support to ASMSC's request to the Secretary of Commerce. So it seems to be the Mid-Atlantic and ASMSC are both moving in the same direction with respect to communications with the Secretary of Commerce. The Mid-Atlantic Council also sent a tasking forward to their Squid Mackerel Butterfish Committee to essentially develop a program that will address the bycatch in their small mesh fisheries. The Squid Mackerel Butterfish fisheries are the small mesh fisheries under the purview of the Mid-Atlantic Council. So they seem to be moving in a direction to hopefully help out with the river herring bycatch issue and river herring data collection issue consistent with the concerns of the ASMSC. And just as a wrap-up, the next commission meeting is going to be the week of August 17th in Alexandria, Virginia.
Winter flounder.
And also, thank you, Terry. Terry reminded me of the winter flounder action taken by ASMSC. The commission approved an addendum that's going to drastically reduce the harvest of winter flounder to complement the interim action that the National Marine Fisheries Service has taken. In the southern New England area, the recreational bag limits can be cut down from 8 fish to 2 fish, and there's going to be a 50-pound commercial bycatch limit. Some of the commission members which are here brought up the concern that a complete closure, complete moratorium in that fishery may increase the discard level, and it would also cut off the supply of fishery data into the stock assessment to support future assessments for southern New England. So the idea was to take a fairly drastic reduction in the southern New England fishery, however, allowed a small amount of fish to come back to the dock for data collection and to avoid some bycatch and discarding. The Gulf of Maine winter flounder fishery is also fairly significantly reduced in order to, again, complement the interim actions taken by the National Marine Fisheries Service. So that's the highlights, and I can obviously answer any questions if you have any, Mr. Chairman.
Before I take questions, anyone else want to add to that? Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, just one point, and it relates to lobster. As usual, a great deal of time was spent by the lobster board on lobster. Gulf of Maine, Georgia's Bank, and elsewhere. I'm not involved in lobster discussions at the ASMSC level. However, I am now aware of what the Executive Committee has undertaken, and I'll refer you to number 9 on page 2 of the memorandum from Paul to us, a summary of the last Executive Committee meeting, and I feel it's necessary to make the point that Paul, when you and your staff deal with impacts of management actions on other fisheries, again, that's number 9 on page 2, you really have to focus on lobster as well and the potential impacts of council actions on ASMSC management for lobster. And I say that with an awareness that with Amendment 16, with all these sectors that will be implemented, there's a potential for a shift of effort onto lobster. So just a heads up on that issue, and my staff, my colleagues, will provide you with any assistance you need to further dig into that one, since ASMFC would be extremely interested in that particular report that you would provide relative to impacts of these management actions on lobster.
Terry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick follow-up on David's point. The Lobster Board did initiate action on limited entry for federal permits in Area 1, and the work will be ongoing.
Anything further on ASMFC? Sally?
A question for Bob. How often does ASMFC request emergency action by the Secretary of Commerce?
I've been at the Commission 12 years, and I think this is the first one that I can remember, so it's a pretty unique event.
I assume that's the case, and was interested, obviously, to hear that the Mid-Atlantic Council is doing something to parallel what ASMFC is doing, and look forward to keeping this discussion going when we turn to Herring tomorrow.
Anything further? Okay, thanks, Bob, Dog, Terry. Moving on, the last item under reports is Council Enforcement Committee. Rodney.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sorry I'm late. After I talked to you, there was three accidents. I didn't know if I was going to make it up here in time. I'm all soaked, but won't be the first time in my life I've been wet. So. Okay, I'll go through this. The Enforcement Committee final report of May 8th, 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 final report